This is Jim Inkster coming today on the show. We will visit with Rod Snyder. He's president of the Young Democrats of America. He's held that position for almost 3 years, and he'll talk about Democratic control of the White House, but lost ground by Democrats in state houses across the land. Also on the show, John DiGiulio, veteran attorney here in Baton Rouge, a man who's involved in freeing men who have been wrongly convicted of murder and are not on death row. We'll talk to John DiGiulio about the death penalty in Louisiana. Of course, we'll also discuss the sacking of Chief Dwayne White, the man who was heading the Baton Rouge Police Department, and a rare ordination taking place this weekend at the Unitarian Church. The man who will be ordained is Nathan Ryan. We'll visit with him. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our numbers are 877-217-5757, wherever you are. If you're dialing locally, 297-5633. We begin with Rod Snyder. He's president of the Young Democrats of America. He's held that position for almost 3 years, frequently on programs of this kind. And if you watch Fox News, you'll see Rod on occasion. Good morning to you, Rod Snyder.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, as a Democrat going on Fox News periodically, as you do, that's kind of throwing the liberals to the lion's den, isn't it?
It's all right. They usually treat me okay, and you know, it's we can have some civil debate. So,
are there any pugnacious people around the Fox News headquarters?
Well, I've done the O'Reilly show a couple of times. That's always a little tough, but I've been on a couple of the other networks as well. But you know, as long as you're willing to have a conversation and you know, are civil to the other folks on the show, you can kind of escape all right. So,
well, as we know, O'Reilly's kind of a tall guy, but I understand that he has his seating position about 4 inches higher than that of his guests. Is that right?
I've always done remote because I'm based out of D.C., so I've always sort of kind of been in the isolation room talking to those folks. So it's you know, I don't know how he has these actual in-studio setup, but you know, that maybe that he does that for intimidation factor. I'm not sure.
Maybe.
I'm 6'6", so it's really hard to tower over
maybe
me.
Maybe that's why he wants you in Washington. He doesn't want any part of Rod Snyder.
That's right.
Well, at 6'6", you're a commanding presence, and I suspect your height has been an asset. It usually is for people of your dimensions, and sometimes we look at candidates like Chris Christie, for example. There are many predicting he'll be the Republican nominee in 2016, but some say some girth control is in order.
Yeah, I mean, it's in the day of 24-hour cable news and kind of the way our political system has evolved in recent years, image is obviously very important. I try not to focus on that too much because, you know, I think there are people in all shapes and sizes that bring various leadership styles and you know, talent to the table. But I'm sure that it's something that Chris Christie's team has to think about and keep in mind as he's continuing to emerge as a national leader. You know, and I have no idea what his plans are going to be for 2016. I tend to think that the bigger issue he has at the moment, more so than his weight, is that on several occasions he's kind of rattled his own, you know, the conservative wing of his party, most notably in the post-Sandy statements that he made that were, you know, somewhat favorable about President Obama right before Election Day. A lot of Republicans feel like the timing of that was not helpful to Mitt Romney, and, you know, I think he still has some fence mending to do inside of his own party, and I'm not sure the conservatives completely trust him yet. I suspect that him getting through a primary, that's going to be his bigger challenge at the moment, even more so than his weight, perhaps.
Well, one of the potential candidates for president on the Republican side, a likely aspirant for the White House in 2016, a man who visited Iowa 6 times last year, is Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana. Here's Bobby Jindal, who ruffled some feathers in the Republican ranks a few weeks ago with some remarks in Charlotte about his GOP brothers and sisters.
We've got to stop being the stupid party. And I'm serious, it's time for a new Republican Party that talks like adults. It's time for us to articulate our plans and our visions for America in real terms.
All right. What do you think of Bobby Jindal? What do you know about him, Rod Snyder?
You know, I've followed Bobby Jindal's career just a little bit. His remarks seem to echo what I'm hearing from a lot of younger Republicans, and contrary to popular opinion, sometimes us young Democrats and young Republicans do get together, and every now and then I check in with the chair or the president of the Young Republicans and College Republicans just to compare notes, and we try to be civil and friends here in D.C. And as we sit around and talk, the things that Bobby Jindal is just saying in that clip are very similar to what I'm hearing from some of the younger leaders in the Republican Party, that they feel like they need a little bit of a new direction. They feel that they need a broader appeal to a broader segment of the electorate than they currently have, and that those types of changes and evolutions need to occur within the Republican Party if they're going to be relevant 10 or 20 years from now. I don't know. Ultimately, that's not my party, so I don't know how that fight is going to play out. Bobby Jindal obviously is wanting to position himself as a reformer in that regard. And, I think that there will be a lot of members of his own party who will find, an appeal to that as 2016 approaches. So I think his strategy is a good one. I think it could help him connect with younger voters within the Republican Party. But the establishment is still very strong, and there's sort of a war for the soul of the Republican Party is really kind of going on right now, and nobody quite knows how it's going to turn out yet.
Well, as we've noted, President Obama won the 2012 election by a margin that was significantly more than many predicted, almost anyone. I don't know of anybody who was predicting he would win by 5 million votes. What does that do as far as his leadership capabilities in the next 4 years? Does it give him leverage in getting his agenda through Congress?
Well, you don't get the honeymoon after an election. It seems shorter and shorter these days. So I think he is not so naive as to think that he's going to be able to just roll through based on his 5 million vote margin. But at the same time, I've noticed folks on Capitol Hill are paying close attention to the outcome of the election, and they understand the changing demographics of the American electorate. And the fact that, for instance, immigration reform has risen to the top of the agenda, or near the top of the agenda for this Congress, I think is a direct result of the 2012 election. And the Latino community has clearly begun to flex their muscle more within the political arena. President Obama benefited from courting that vote early on, and that was an important part of his margin of victory. The youth vote as well, I believe, is something that is becoming an important part of sort of the Democratic Party's constituency group. As those demographics continue to change and evolve, I think you're going to see the types of issues that are addressed on the national scene are also going to shift and evolve as well. And, I think that helps President Obama in his second term, because he can point to some of that support as he's, rallying his base around issues of gun control and immigration reform and education funding and things of this nature. So, it's already starting to happen. And I suspect that trend will continue.
297-5633 for Rod Snyder. He is president of the Young Democrats of America. He is from West Virginia, where he has been active in politics in his home state for several years. And that is a state, much like Louisiana, that has veered rightward. It is a red state now. It once was a solidly blue state. And the gun control issues that you just enunciated, they don't fly as well in some states as they do in others. Here in Louisiana, there's already been a bill pre-filed that would ban state enforcement of any new federal restrictions on semi-automatic firearms. What's your assessment, Rod, on where this issue is going, particularly in states like yours and ours?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's certainly the hottest issue, I would say, at the moment in West Virginia, aside from perhaps coal mining, which is a perennial issue for us in West Virginia. But the gun control debate brings out just a lot of emotions from both sides, and you even felt it during the State of the Union address. There was probably not a moment last week when President Obama was speaking where the emotion in the room was quite as high as when he began talking about the victims of mass shootings in the last couple of years and how the country should respond to that. And there are strong opinions about how to move forward. And I think if you just, from a pragmatic political perspective, if you look at the makeup of the current Congress, and you look at also even Democrats from rural areas like West Virginia that you know have constituents that feel strongly on these issues, I do believe that it's going to be very difficult to get, for instance, even the assault weapon ban that passed in 1994. I think under current conditions, it will be very, very hard to get a bill like that passed again right now. I believe the White House probably already understands that, although they're not going to let their foot off the gas. At the end of the day, if I'm just kind of making some prognostication, I think the background check, the universal background checks, are going to be probably something that's more possible to get done, as well as some of the clips or the size of the magazine, the size of the magazines, some of those issues versus an assault weapon ban, which I believe has run into a lot of roadblocks. So at the end of the day, maybe no one gets everything that they want out of this particular issue. Of course, time will tell, and there's still a lot of legislating that needs to take place. But looking into a crystal ball right now, it seems that both sides might take away some victories, but no one's going to get everything.
Okay. Now, in this environment, we have Democrats have won 5 of the last 6 popular votes for president and lost one very close one when John Kerry was defeated by President Bush. So on a national level, Democrats are a party in which the positions have been embraced by the electorate. But locally, meaning in states, only 23 states have Democratic governors and only 18 have democratically controlled legislatures. This is a case in which the U.S. House of Representatives, Rod, for example, is majority Republican, but Democrats got a majority of the votes. The gerrymandering of districts has enabled Republicans to gain control of seats in the federal Congress at the state level. How do you address this situation?
This is a really good point that you're making as far as just overall. Quite frankly, there's sort of a series of issues that have been coming up recently. I would kind of just put into overall sort of election reform. Obviously, gerrymandering is a concern on a variety of levels. I think it's helped to polarize the Congress because our state legislatures are creating safe districts on both sides, where you don't have a ton of moderate swing seats anymore, like you perhaps once had, and so you have people coming to Congress that are really never at risk of losing a general election because of the makeup of those districts. You also saw in 2010 Republicans really benefiting from the 2010 midterm elections and the victories that they had across the country with the census. At that point, they were able to obviously in most states take charge of the redistricting process and also drew seats that were favorable for them. So if you look at the map, as you just mentioned, even though Democrats are winning a majority of the votes for Congress across the country, it's very, very difficult for Democrats to find a path to get back to the majority in the House of Representatives simply because of the way the map is drawn. So, that's a frustration for those of us on the Democratic side. However, those are currently the way that the rules are written. Other large concerns that I have are things that, President Obama talked about it in the State of the Union address about people waiting in long lines to be able to vote up to 6 or 7 hours, particularly in urban centers or minority populations that are facing, almost sometimes double the wait time of white voters across the country. There's some nonpartisan groups that did some research around that from 2012. That's a major concern. That's something that needs to be addressed. And even new bills like voter ID laws, things that are making it just a little bit harder to be able to access the voting booth, all of those things are concerns. I think that this country needs to be moving in a direction of more accessibility, easier voting access, and to be able to preserve democracy.
All right, we'll return with Rod Snyder, president of Young Democrats of America. 297-5633 is your number. Also, we'll hear from John DiGiulio, veteran lawyer in this area. He has some thoughts about politics and the death penalty. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Rod Snyder. He is president of Young Democrats of America. He's held that position since 2010. He's worked in politics in his home state of West Virginia for many years and has also been a candidate. How was it when you got in the arena, Rod?
It was a lot of fun. I was 23 years old when I ran for the state house, so just trying to figure things out, you know, at a young age. And my dad has served in the state senate for many years, so kind of grew up in a political family. And but nothing is quite the same as putting your name on, you know, on the ballot yourself. So I learned a lot from that. It was a really good starting point for my political career, and perhaps at some point I'll run again.
How'd you do?
I lost in a primary to a long-term incumbent, but, you know, I matched his fundraising and got my name out there, and, you know, it was overall a very positive experience.
Well, in his State of the Union address, President Obama called for a 24% increase in the minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $9 an hour, and he has been greeted with both praise and criticism for this proposal. What's your take on the capacity for something like this to gain momentum?
Mm-hmm. It was one of the more significant proposals out of the State of the Union address, I believe. And he talked about how a lot of pundits have talked about how even Mitt Romney conceded that perhaps the minimum wage should be tied to cost of living, like a lot of other things are, and we, you know, we don't see adjustments on a regular basis unless Congress intervenes. I think in today's economy, it's just very, very difficult for a family that's trying to make ends meet and you know, raise a family on $7.15 an hour, and so to be able to get that bump up to $9 or something, you know, similar to that, could make a big difference for, you know, for families that are trying to, you know, work. There's about 15 million Americans who are basically working at, you know, at the minimum wage level. And for those people, I think it would be extremely significant to them.
Well, we thank you for joining us today. Rod Snyder, president of Young Democrats of America. We look forward to another visit soon. Thank you, Rod.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. My pleasure. And we're joined in studio now by the veteran attorney, John DiGiulio, who has a famous name in this community. A restaurant with his name is positioned nicely at the Perkins Road overpass. You were involved with that establishment for quite a few years, weren't you?
Quite a few years, yes, mostly as an investor and a patron.
And a patron. Well, many high-level meetings take place at that establishment, as they do in others here in Baton Rouge. We're a social city, and one of the issues that was talked about in the last few days is a decision by Federal Judge Jim Brady to stay the execution of a man, Christopher Sepulvado, because the state failed to provide details about its new execution protocol. And John DiGiulio, who is with the Trial Lawyers Compliance Board, Compliance Officer for the Public Defender
State
Board.
State Public Defender Board,
right.
Correct.
You're involved intricately in this particular issue. What's your assessment on the death penalty in Louisiana and nationally?
Well, let me just say, in my professional capacity, we don't have a position on whether or not it should be repealed. Personally, of course, I have my own views. The biggest problem with the death penalty are, first of all, the system is not accurate enough to avoid mistakes. There are some six exonerees off of Louisiana death row, over 100 nationally. In addition to many cases that have been reversed for failure to abide by basic due process standards, even though the defendant may have been guilty. But there are also these where innocent people end up on death row. In addition to that, the cost of the death penalty is something that I think if the public really understood it would change a lot of minds. The United States Supreme Court has said death is different, and there are different kinds of rules for representation recommended by the American Bar Association and approved by the Louisiana Supreme Court. That includes you have to have two certified lawyers in every capital case. You have to have a mitigation specialist and an investigator. So automatically you have a team of at least four in any mm-hmm. death penalty case. One of the things that drives the cost up, too, is that the best practices and the protocol established in Louisiana by the through the Administrative Procedures Act basically requires that a case be treated as a capital case until the district attorney says it's not. So from the time of arrest until the district attorney takes death off the table, that case has to be staffed by at least those four individuals.
All and right. Well, you're giving me a lot to work with. I did want to note about one particular case, John. Damon Thibodeau, 38, last September he was released after spending 15 years on death row for a murder he did not commit. He was exonerated by the Innocence Project, which you know well. Here's a man who's lost much of his life. Went to jail when he was 23, 38. What happens to a guy when he is released like that? Did they just put him out on the street and say, sorry, we made a mistake?
Well, there is a statutory scheme to compensate persons up to a certain amount. It certainly doesn't compensate them for that amount of time. There have been some lawsuits. In fact, there was a one that went all the way to the United States Supreme Court where a district attorney's office, it was actually the Orleans district attorney when Harry Connick was the DA, was found liable by a jury to the tune of $40 million or with interest, and the Supreme Court ended up reversing it, and that was based on the fact that the DA's office had been shown to have hidden exculpatory evidence that would have indicated innocence. So it's very difficult to really get adequately compensated. There, every year in the legislature, there are bills to try to raise the amount that is awarded to those wrongfully convicted. And it's not just capital cases. I mean, the Innocence Project has over 30 exonerations of individuals serving life or very long sentences, in addition to the death row exonerations. But to show you the expense of it, the Angola case, which the Public Defender Board did not fund and was not involved in, it predated the establishment of the Public Defender Board. But by statute, the Department of Corrections has to pay the defense bills for anyone who is accused of a crime committed while in the custody of the Department of Corrections. That was an escape attempt, five defendants. The bill so far is in the neighborhood of $10 million for one case, five defendants.
All right, 85 men are on death row in Louisiana at Angola, some of whom have been convicted with overwhelming DNA evidence, such as Derek Todd Lee. Do you think there's a distinction between somebody like Lee and someone like Damon Thibodeau, who was innocent and found guilty, I suppose, on circumstantial evidence? If you know beyond a shadow of doubt, Derek Todd Lee killed several women. Why not kill him and let the others serve life in prison and fight for exoneration?
Well, there's certainly a distinction between those cases, obviously. I don't know the facts, the underlying facts of either case intricately enough to discuss it. But one of the reasons that a capital case is so expensive is the requirement that mitigation evidence be developed and presented. And in a capital case, regardless of the horrendous nature of the guilt phase facts, there are almost always incredible backstories about individuals who were abused with mental diseases that could sway a jury not to give them the death penalty. Those are other issues in a lot of cases that have been overturned where the evidence of guilt is very strong. The basis for the higher courts overturning them is the failure to adequately pursue and present that mitigation evidence.
In Lee's case, though, he killed several women, and maybe some we don't even know about, and as noted, overwhelming evidence, DNA proof that he did it. Since he's been in prison, John, he's had a pacemaker installed. The taxpayers of Louisiana are paying for his housing, his food. What good does it do when we're talking about costs to keep a guy like him alive?
Well, that's a judgment that society has made, and it's one that we live with. I do know very little about that case, but I do know that there are some serious issues involving the DNA analysis that the Post-Conviction Project is trying to get information about and facing some resistance. And that's one of the reasons
In his case?
In his case, yes.
Of course, he was found to be involved in several murders, a serial killer. I don't know how he could be exonerated at this point.
I don't know that exoneration is the issue. It's whether or not he's ultimately executed is another question. But if there is one of the factors in a jury's decision to impose the death penalty or not is what's known in the business as residual doubt. If the DNA evidence, for instance, was tampered with or the testing was not done properly, then that could raise a residual doubt issue, which may have affected a jury in deciding to impose the death sentence. I tried a case in Jefferson Parish where I believe that the jury came back with a life sentence because of the residual doubt in the guilt phase.
Okay. Larry asks, how many death row inmates in the United States have been killed and then later found to be innocent through DNA evidence? Do we know?
I don't know the answer to that. I know there was a fairly high-profile one in Texas that was written up in the New Yorker that involved an arson case where it seems pretty clear now that he was executed and innocent. A lot of times, of course, there is no DNA evidence in a lot of cases, and that's one of the things, of course, the Innocence Project has to deal with a lot of times is the wrongful convictions are often based on bad eyewitness testimony. Sometimes it's bad science. Some of the junk science is what it's often called by the Innocence Project people. So there are a lot of other – most cases don't have DNA. It's just – and especially if they're older cases when – before DNA was really developed as a forensic tool.
297-5633 for Attorney John DiGiulio, who – is a trial lawyer compliance officer with the Public Defender Board. Now, John, I recall 1987, there were 7 executions at Angola that summer in just a few month span. I don't know, we've had maybe 1 execution in Louisiana in the last decade. Why has there been this change?
I think there is there's more scrutiny by the appellate courts of the process. The exonerations have, I think, had a bit of a chilling effect on prosecutions, so that courts are more inclined to make sure we get it right. I think that's one issue. I think the national trend, of course, is toward either abolishing the death penalty or legislating a moratorium so that we can study it more and decide whether it makes sense to go forward. We could actually, in Louisiana, if we didn't have to spend the amount of money that we spend on capital cases, and frankly, we don't have enough to adequately represent the ones that we have, we could actually make the public defender system fully funded, which it is not now.
Now, an execution I witnessed in 1987 on the 16th day of June, the man who was killed, Jimmy Wingo, he did not kill anybody. He was with a man who killed 2 people while they were robbing a house, and he got the death penalty too, which is the law of the state of Louisiana. What about the selective enforcement? There are people who commit the most heinous crimes and don't get the death penalty, and there are others like Wingo who was not the trigger man. That's not in doubt. And yet he was executed at the age of 35.
Well, and that's a serious problem. The fact is, you won't find any rich people on death row. You'll find mostly minorities on death row in any state. So there is an issue about selective prosecution. You will also find that most even the cases where an individual originally had a private counsel, because of how difficult and expensive it is, the public defender system always ends up with those one way or the other, either midway before trial or after trial. So there, it's a serious problem and one that needs to be looked at even more.
Danny asks the question for you. He says, with our spiraling murder rate in Baton Rouge, would a swift death penalty process assist in thwarting crime in this city?
I don't know of a single respectable study that has really established any deterrent effect. The death penalty, most homicides are created are a result of either anger, a barroom killing, often family issues, course of armed robberies. But I don't know of any study that's shown that those people would have made a different decision if they had been facing the death penalty rather than life in prison. In Louisiana, life in prison actually means life in prison. There's a graveyard at Angola that I used to have a picture of in my office, which shows numerous people that have been given life sentences in Louisiana who died at Angola. So it's a if there's a deterrent effect, I think that the incarceration itself is equal to anything that the death penalty. I don't think people that commit those kinds of offenses are sitting around thinking, gee, I might get the death penalty rather than life in prison, frankly.
You've been to death row, haven't you, at Angola?
Yes, I have.
It's an interesting place.
It is. Actually, I have a daughter now that does death penalty appellate work, and she goes there fairly often.
What's your take on what it's like for those people on death row waiting? Some people would say death is the easy way out. That's not a very pleasant life.
No, it isn't. In fact, when I did that kind of work, I was not very good at talking defendants into taking life sentences, which are often offered. And I think part of it was because I couldn't imagine myself making that choice.
Well,
and
the last guy who was executed, he was executed because he wanted to be executed, right?
Exactly. He was what they call a volunteer. That's correct. If I were in that position, I think I would have a hard time saying, I'd like to spend the rest of my life on death row.
297-5633. We'll continue with veteran lawyer John DiGiulio, and we'll also hear from Nathan Ryan. He will be ordained as a minister in the Unitarian Church. This is a rare happening, and it's going to happen right here in Baton Rouge this week. Back after this 90-second timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Inkster Show at WRKF.org works as well. For John DiGiulio, a few more minutes with this well-versed attorney. He's been in the legal field for almost 40 years, and John DiGiulio's handled some of the most celebrated cases in this area. He is now working as a trial lawyer compliance officer with the Public Defender Board. And a question from John. He asks about the process now for executions in Louisiana. We have lethal injection. Has this made it more palatable than the electrocutions that we used to witness?
Well, there's a lot of litigation involving the protocol and the chemicals used. There is some evidence that that some, even though the appearance of the person being executed, it doesn't show it, that there may be serious pain and suffering involved that may violate the cruel and unusual punishment clause of the state and federal constitution. So that's something that's being litigated all over the country and is one of the reasons that Judge Brady believes that the defense has the right to the information about the chemicals to be used.
All right. A note about tomorrow's show. We were slated to hear from Tim Barfield, who runs the Department of Revenue now, and he has much to talk about regarding the governor's tax proposal. But Tim's sister, his older sister Jill, died in Arkansas, and funeral services will be tomorrow at the Showtime in Little Rock, and so he will be unavailable to be with us. But John Bell Edwards, representing the loyal opposition, Democrat from Ameet, he'll be here. And we'll also hear from Councilwoman Denise Marcel, who I'm sure will have much to say about the firing of Chief Dwayne White. Kevin, let's give a listen to Mayor Holden yesterday when Chief White was given his walking papers.
Chief, I too believe that I'm looking out for the welfare of the citizens of Baton Rouge and East Baton Rouge Parish. Because you chose to misrepresent my record today, shame on you. And I hope at some point you analyze the statements that you made and tell the truth to the people of Baton Rouge, because they deserve better.
Mayor Melvin Kip Holden. You've known him for years, haven't you?
I've known Kip for a long time. I've known him actually when he was a defense lawyer before he became a politician. And I consider him a friend.
He brought this man to the dance. He made him chief. Something went wrong.
Jim, I don't have any inside information. I read the paper. I have represented persons accused falsely by police officers, and I've represented police officers, some of whom were falsely accused by the system. One of the things that does strike me, and let me say this has more to do probably with my experience where I practiced in New Orleans at the same time as I practice here in Baton Rouge, that the idea of community policing is one that I think is just a remarkable idea, and one that, unfortunately, I have seen resistance among police officers and police unions. It's difficult. It requires sometimes putting precincts in housing projects. But what I learned in representing some individuals that were accused of very serious offenses in housing projects and in poorer sections of particularly of New Orleans, but I think it goes on here too, is that the idea that witnesses don't come forward because they're afraid of retaliation by the offenders, drug dealers, or whatever, there's also a factor that's very important, and that is that a lot of them don't trust the police, and they don't trust the police because the police have not treated grandma nicely. They haven't gotten to know anybody in the neighborhood. And I'm not saying this is always the case, but there are two components to the inability to get those witnesses. One is the fear factor, but the other is the distrust of the police department. And it seems to me that the idea of community policing is one that can perhaps bridge that gap. That seems to be involved in this controversy. But as I say, I don't know the facts. I wouldn't necessarily second guess Mayor Holden's decision. But in reading the newspaper anyway, and anecdotally from some people I know that have been, pulled over in these so-called high crime neighborhoods in a way that would not be tolerated in the suburbs, I think there's some issue involving the resistance to community policing concepts involved here.
All right. We'll hear tomorrow from C. Denise Marcel, Councilwoman. Of course, one of the issues that has emanated from this controversy with the chief and the mayor is whether or not the chief should be elected. You have any thoughts on that?
I don't know enough about it, Jim, to know whether that's a good idea or not. It may be a good compromise would be for to sort of do like the national system for nominating cabinet officers, where the mayor nominates and the council advises and consents.
Right.
Maybe that would be a good compromise. I don't know about the election process, frankly.
And you knew Pat Screen in his 8 years. You knew him well.
I knew him very well. I represented him on a number of issues.
He had some problems with the police chief at one time as well.
You know, I don't remember that part. That was not something I represented him on, but it wouldn't surprise me. He was a strong leader, as is Mayor Holden.
Yeah, and it'll be fascinating to see who ends up being the chief. It looks like Chief White is gone, though. That's another question that certainly will evolve over the next few weeks or months. Why is the chief fighting like this?
Well, and I don't know. I don't understand the law, frankly. It's not my area. I don't understand whether or not he has civil service protection or not. I was told originally by a lawyer that I respect a lot in employment areas that he serves completely at the will of the mayor. But apparently there are others that say he has some civil service protection. I don't know the answer.
He's got a very good attorney. Does the mayor, by the way.
They both have good lawyers, and neither are shy to speak their minds.
We're talking about Jill Craft and Murphy Foster, and for those who have followed their careers, the two of them going at it is quite theatrical.
It ought to be filmed.
Well, thank you, John. Let's do it again.
Thank you, Jim.
Talk to you later.
See you at the restaurant.
There you go. And we're joined in studio now by Nathan Ryan, a native of our state and a graduate of LSU. Young man, Nathan, how young are you?
33.
33 and about to become a minister in the Unitarian Church. And those in the congregation, several members asked me to showcase you, saying this is a rare happening.
It is. So within Unitarian Universalism, ordination only happens through a vote of the congregation. So it's only when the congregation finds someone they deem worthy of.
So we don't elect our police chief, but we elect our Unitarian ministers, right?
Correct.
So
correct.
Will there be like an up and down vote come? It's Sunday, right?
It's Sunday at 5:30. They've already had the vote, so I don't mean to ruin the surprise, but they voted in December.
You're in.
I am.
You're in.
It's a matter of the ceremony.
Okay, and this is at the Unitarian Church on Goodwood Boulevard, and they haven't had an ordination there in quite some time, right?
Yeah, never.
Never.
Is correct.
As in never.
Right. It's a, you know, Unitarian Universalism is a long, long tradition, and they ordain out of their own, so to speak. Someone gets pulled up from the congregation to be ordained.
And why did they pull you up at age 33?
Well, that's the tradition, right?
Yeah.
I was brought in because I was the best candidate to be their assistant minister in the country.
Steve Crump's been there a while, so when his time comes to step down, will you be the heir apparent? Is that
no,
the way it works?
No.
No.
It's,
so you may go somewhere else?
That's far off. We don't know about that. This is about growing the church and growing the ministry in the church. Steve's been there 30 years, which is anomalous in almost every faith. And he's turned that church into something with the congregation, something amazing.
Well, how does your church factor in the fact that we're in a community that's largely Catholic and those who are not Roman Catholic, many are evangelical Protestants? The Unitarian Church is different.
Yeah, so we are a church that does not focus, there's no creedal test to belong to the Unitarian Universalist Church. We're more focused on how you live out your belief than what you believe. Belief is really the way we make sense of our own experience. And so to say only certain people have a certain belief or a certain experience are welcomed here is not how we do things.
So if I were to ask you, for example, if you were a Christian, what would your answer be?
My answer is I'm a Unitarian Universalist. So we don't specify on what specific belief structure one has. I personally believe that Jesus lived a life that has given billions of people hope, and that is certainly worthy of everyone's acclaim.
But you don't believe he was God?
No more than any other person is God. But this is still a focus on belief, right? So you can have someone else in our church who is an adamant atheist and someone else who is a universalist Christian who believes in God's love and Jesus's life as a model for how we're going to live.
Well, Jack Germond, the famous columnist and commentator who's with us every now and then, who's an atheist. He says that in political life, when somebody's an atheist, they generally don't say they're an atheist. They say they're a member of the Unitarian Church.
There are a lot of people in our church who believe in God, and a lot of people who believe in the Christian way of living. But this is back to that focus on belief. Our church is more focused on sharing your truth and spiritual growth.
But if you're a Catholic, a Protestant, a Jew, a Muslim, a Hindu, you can join your church. You really take it, or an atheist. You take all comers, don't you?
Yeah. There are certain beliefs that if you come, you may not feel as welcome. So if you believe men are inherently more worthy of God's love than women, you may have a hard time finding a place in our church. We're a church that has had a long commitment to justice and inclusion. And many people know it. There's the big circle window that is part of the church's architecture, that it's about inclusion, drawing the circle big enough to bring everyone in.
Well, I must say the times I've been to your church, unfortunately, has been when somebody I know has passed away or there's some event. Mm-hmm. But I've never been to a service in the Christian faith and in other faiths. It's all about trying to do what the Lord wants and trying to get to a better place if you believe in an afterlife. What's the focus of the Unitarian Church?
Well, we don't focus on the afterlife. In some biblical scholars would say we're focusing on Jesus' description of the afterlife, which is life here on earth after we're gone. So it's about living our lives in a way that will build a holier world on earth now. So that means working towards compassion and justice and kindness and forgiveness and love.
297-5633 is your number for Nathan Ryan. He'll be the first person ordained at the Unitarian Church on Goodwood in Baton Rouge. It's been around for a while. How many years?
62 years.
62 years. First guy in 62 years. So what's the ceremony like?
The ceremony is as high church as Unitarian Universalists do, which is probably lower church than most Episcopals would be comfortable with. We have clergy coming in from Maryland and Texas and all over the place, and they're speaking on ministry. And what's unique is, within the Unitarian Universalist Church, the only institution that makes someone the Reverend Nathan Ryan, or the Reverend whomever, is the congregation, right? So there's no pope, there's no bishop. It's only through a vote of the congregation. So you could extrapolate that down and look at the power of the congregation and the individual congregant for what they're able to give to aspiring clergy.
And as far as membership, how many members of the Unitarian Church are there in the United States? Do you know?
It depends on how you count. The easiest number would probably be about 150,000 to 200,000.
In the whole
In the United States. They've done surveys of people about, they've called people and said, what religion are you? And then they've extrapolated out, how many there are. And based on those numbers, we've got about 800,000.
I know you have a close-knit congregation and people who have different beliefs. How do you keep it all together? I guess that's a question more for Reverend Crump, but obviously you probably have the most diverse congregation of any church in the city.
It's absolutely challenging. So when you lead a service, we have what we call the freedom of the pulpit and the freedom of the pew. So whomever is preaching on any Sunday, they have an obligation to preach their truth as they know it. But that does not mean that the member in the congregation sitting in the pew is under obligation to take their truth as their truth. So that's where this freedom is. And so when you say God in church or you say prayer to one person, it speaks exactly to their life experience and their understanding of the Most High. And to another person, it speaks to the same God that told them they weren't allowed to get married because they're gay.
All right. Now, what do you think about religion and public life in America, Nathan? Has it been a help or is it a hindrance to uniting the people of this country?
Yes. it's a human institution, right? So it does some good and it does some harm.
Is there more of one than the other?
Well, I would hope there's more good than harm.
You would hope, but in reality, is that the case?
I would say so. You know, it's been accredited to Martin Luther King and Abraham Lincoln, but it originated with an old Unitarian minister, Theodore Parker, who said the arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice, meaning we're doing better, but we're nowhere near where we need to be.
That quote, by the way, has been attributed to Martin Luther King. You say it's Theodore Parker's quote.
So King was quoting Abraham Lincoln, who was quoting Theodore Parker in the early 1800s. He was an abolitionist who would sit in his he would keep a gun in his pulpit and harbor fugitive slaves.
Okay, well, congratulations on your ordination this Sunday, 5:30 at the Unitarian Church. Nathan
Thanks.
Ryan, thank you, sir. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, for Kevin, I'm Jim. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.